From Kansas to Virginia, Oregon to Pennsylvania, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Donald Trump has nominated Kevin Warsh to be the new chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Ryan Young from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here to discuss the nominee and the nomination. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed the Save America Act, which would require proof of citizenship to vote in federal elections. It now heads to the Senate. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Congressional Budget Office has released its 10-year budget projections. It's not a pretty picture. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Romina Bocha of the Cato Institute. And in 1984, Ronald Reagan won re-election in a 49-state landslide. Is it now possible for any candidate to achieve such a sweeping victory? Keith Rothfuss has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The term of Federal Reserve Board Chairman Jerome Powell expires in May, and President Donald Trump has nominated Kevin Warsh to be the new chairman. To learn more about the nominee and the process, we turn to Ryan Young. He is senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Ryan, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Ryan, we have a nominee to head the Federal Reserve. President Trump has made his selection. And everybody listening should pay attention to this guy because his policies, his actions are really going to have an impact and touch on the lives of every American as we go forward. So, drum roll, who has the president picked, and can you tell us a bit about him?
His name is Kevin Warsh. He's got the resume. He's got the qualifications, but it's the great unknown as to how he will behave once he's in office. The president wants low interest rates, easy money, and stimulus as far as the eye can see. The trade-off to that is very high inflation as a result. Stimulus now means inflation later. There's always a trade-off. So Warsh was picked in part for his loyalty to the president because the president thinks that he will pursue that type of agenda. But Warsh's track record, and it's a pretty decent track record, is a mixed bag in that regard. So it's an unknown, and the Senate's going to try to figure that out once his confirmation hearings start.
And speaking of that, what is the process here? He now has to go before the Senate. The current term of the Federal Reserve Chairman scheduled to end, what, in May? So this is a timely matter?
Yes. Jerome Powell, the current Fed Chairman's term ends on May 15. So right now, as we speak, Warsh, the nominee, is making the traditional informal tour of Senate offices, having one-on-one meetings with senators, asking their question or answering their questions, trying to calm their concerns. And then after that, hearings will start, and the Senate will hold a vote in time, so he will likely be installed. I would expect him to pass, but not without controversy, by May 15, when the term would properly begin.
And the confirmation process for a Federal Reserve Chairman, that's a simple majority, correct? It doesn't have to get to that two-thirds filibuster-proof majority?
Yes, but the math isn't all that great for Republicans, in part because of Tom Tillis, a retiring senator from North Carolina, who has said that despite the fact that he believes that Warsh is qualified for the job, will vote against him unless the Trump administration drops its purely political criminal investigation into the current chairman, Jerome Powell. The reason for that investigation isn't because of anything he might have done wrong. It's because he hasn't lowered interest rates the way the president wants.
Ryan, you mentioned the trade-off. If you lower interest rates, the president, of course, wants to address this affordability issue and bringing down interest rates so folks can afford to go out and buy a new home, move up to a larger home, buy a new vehicle, whatever. He's trying to push for that. But if we do see a lowering of interest rates, is it probable that we're going to see increased inflation even before the midterm elections this November?
It's possible. Anything the Fed does has a lag time. So anything to do now in February won't start having effect on the economy until at least August, September, October. So to the extent that the president wants to juice the economy in advance of the election, he only has a few months to do it. Maybe the new chairman would have one interest rate meeting to do that. So he has to tread very carefully, because not only will it not take effect for a few months, but of course you get that trade-off of higher inflation. And there's an even worse trade-off. If the president succeeds in pressuring the Fed to lower interest rates, he's actually going to get higher interest rates. A little counterintuitive, but if markets think that the Fed isn't calling its own shots, if markets think that it's essentially a puppet for the president, well, then the Fed doesn't have any integrity. They're just going to do inflation as far as the eye can see. Markets are going to react to that by raising interest rates on government debt and other things, because that's much riskier than it is under an independent Fed. So the president has to be very careful here, otherwise his low interest rate policy could backfire.
The Fed, of course, held interest rates steady at their most recent meeting. Ryan, you're, of course, an economist, which is why we have these chats from time to time. In terms of keeping inflation under control, do you see their current policy as having the intended impact?
It's roughly where it should be. Economic growth is pretty solid. It's over 4%. Normal is about 2%. The labor market, showing some cracks, but any unemployment rate under 5% is pretty good. We're at about 4.5%, so we're pretty good. When you have those two fundamentals in decent shape, you don't need stimulus. You don't need to lower interest rates. The trouble is that there is already high inflation, which means that the Fed also might want to raise interest rates to combat that inflation, but that risks a possible slowdown, because although labor and growth are decent, they're a little fragile. So the Fed's really in a tough place, and I think holding steady for now was a good move. And it also sent a signal that, yes, we're still independent of what the president wants. He's always going to pressure for lower rates, and the Fed bucking that and saying we're going to hold rates steady for now based on what we see in the economy is a good sign. And if anything, that should reassure markets.
Taking a look at this then, Ryan, if in fact rates remain fairly steady, the Fed will have an opportunity, as you pointed out, at multiple meetings to perhaps change that rate. But the Fed chairman, even if we have a new chairman come on board in May, he's only one vote in this, correct? Isn't there a board of governors that will have its say? So it doesn't necessarily mean a wholesale change in approach or policy?
That's right. At those interest rate meetings every 6 weeks, the chairman is one vote out of 12. And the president appoints some of the other members. And he's been doing what he can, not just by opening a criminal investigation into Jerome Powell, but also doing the same thing to another member of the Board of Governors to try to get his own people on board. But so far, those efforts have not succeeded. So hopefully the Fed will be able to use that structure to its advantage and pursue policy as it sees fit, rather than essentially becoming a puppet of one of the political branches of government.
We have been talking with Ryan Young, who is a senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Ryan, as always, tell us a little bit about CEI, also your website, because you do a lot of writing on this and other topics.
The website is cei.org, and we are a think tank based in Washington. We focus on regulatory issues and expanding economic freedom.
Ryan Young of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Ryan, as always, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Loman.
Scott Parkinson at the offices of the Club for Growth. There's been a lot of action on Capitol Hill. Also, some interesting developments in congressional races around the country. We're going to cover all of that with Scott. Scott, great to have you here.
It's my pleasure.
The House of Representatives, Scott, has passed the Save America Act. And first of all, let's remind our listeners what it is. It heads to the Senate. What are the chances?
Things are heating up in Washington, D.C. The ice from a few weeks ago is starting to melt a little bit. The sidewalks are still a mess. Congress is still a mess. But it seems like they are making some progress for a couple of the key priorities within the Trump agenda and Republican coalition that we've got with our majorities. So the Save America Act would prevent non-U.S. citizens from voting in American elections. They also added a provision to require photo ID. There's a lot of misinformation being floated out there from the Democrats saying that this will make it impossible for married women who have changed their names to be able to vote. And I think a lot of us over the past couple of years have gone through this process to get a real ID, and women figured out how to find their marriage licenses and update their photo ID at that time. So I think they can use that to go ahead and vote in future elections as well if this bill becomes law. On the Senate side, Mike Lee has changed the bill to add in that photo ID provision. So he had to go back to the drawing board and get all these senators signed up as co-sponsors again. And he's in the high 40s. There's a few holdouts, and there's that continued discussion on whether or not John Thune is going to try to do the standing filibuster so that you can move to passage when the Democrats are exhausted. You know, the last time that we did this to a degree of success was in the Civil Rights Act, and that took about 60 days to get that bill through. But it wasn't a process where the bill passed with 51 votes. In the end, the Senate was actually legislating, adopting various provisions, considering amendments, and I think it passed with over 70 votes in the United States Senate. And anyway, so I think there's a lot of optimism that we can get the bill through the United States Senate. We've got to get all the Republican senators aligned. And if your senator's holding out in the state of Maine or Alaska or Kentucky or somewhere else, you know, you need to make sure your voice is heard.
So we will continue to track that big impact here for the upcoming midterm elections. Meanwhile, Congress has successfully funded all the government agencies until the 1st of October, except the Department of Homeland Security. As we record, that appears to be hung up. What is happening there? Is there going to be an impact that people are going to actually feel at any time in the near future?
Well, I think that partial government shutdowns are mostly political theater. The Department of Homeland Security appropriations bill is expected to be filibustered, and we're going to probably be entering into a partial shutdown of some of the DHS authorities. And there are things like the Coast Guard that's going to continue to receive funding from, you know, money that it received in 2025. The TSA right now seems like everything's going to be okay through mid-March. You've also got enough money for FEMA, about $7 billion, to keep it going for a couple of months. And so that partial government shutdown of the agency would be effectively furlough of a lot of employees and slowing down the work of that major department and if the agencies within it. But I think that a lot of people at DHS are deemed essential employees, and so most of the work is going to be ongoing. These senators right now, they're also expected to be in a recess next week, and there's a bunch of them that are sort of getting that smell of jet fumes in their nose, and they're ready to head to Munich for a security conference out there in Germany. Lisa Murkowski said recently, quote, "I'm going to go home and I'm packing for Munich and I'm packing for Alaska. That's my plan and I'm sticking to it," end quote. And, you know, if that's the attitude that I think these people have, it's like the American people really do expect more from our elected leaders. You need to stay in Washington, D.C., finish the work before you, make sure that our nation's homeland security is funded and that we are a safe and secure nation.
Interesting that the impetus for all of this is the Democrats want reform to ICE, but the ICE budget's already funded for several years, so aren't they sort of shooting at the wrong target, if you will?
It's, again, like I said, political theater. I think that the Democrats want to make an issue out of what happened in Minneapolis, but honestly, the news cycle seems to have moved on. Tom Homan is on the ground in Minneapolis, and I don't see that as a breaking story each and every night. I think that the American people are more interested in what's going on in Tucson, Arizona with Savannah Guthrie's mother.
Let's talk here for a minute or two, Scott, about congressional races. Some key developments in Texas. Want to fill us in?
Chip Roy in the 21st District of Texas is running for Attorney General of Texas. So this is one of those open seats. The election, I think, is on March 3rd. And Club for Growth PAC this week endorsed former Major League Baseball All-Star and World Series champion Mark Teixeira. And you might say, well, it's just another athlete going to Congress. I think Mark Teixeira is very different. He's been incredibly successful after his professional career as an investor and an entrepreneur. And he really understands the economic issues that are crushing business today.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, fill us in a bit on the club. Also, where can folks find you on the web?
Club for Growth is an organization that has over 525,000 members from all 50 states in our great country. And we are united in this idea of economic freedom and liberty and opportunity. If you want to visit our website, it's clubforgrowth.org. You can actually sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
The Congressional Budget Office has issued a dire 10-year federal budget outlook. For a look at the situation, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Romina Bocha of the Cato Institute. Eric?
$16 trillion. It's a staggering amount of money, but that is what Americans will spend. $16 trillion in your tax dollars that will go to paying the interest on the national debt over the next 10 years. That's according to some new numbers that we got just this week from the Congressional Budget Office, which released its 10-year budget and economic projections. Always a big day on my calendar, maybe not on yours, but on mine. And among the many, many numbers in that report, that $16 trillion in interest costs over the next decade is one that really jumped off the page to me. We're going to dig into that report and the significance of that figure with my guest today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That guest is Romina Bocia. She's the Director of Federal Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute, a friend of mine, a friend of the program here. We're glad to have her back. Thank you for taking some time and joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It is a big day for budget wonks, and it's unfortunately a bad day for America because CBO has once again told us that the federal budget situation is highly unsustainable. It is getting worse, and yet Congress is asleep at the wheel.
Yeah, it is. I suppose, you know, we could say it's a bad day because we see the numbers on a day like this. Although really, it's these numbers, they exist. This debt, the debt exists, the costs exist. We're going to have to pay them back. And so in some ways, having that out in front and having a discussion about it, I think is certainly worth it. We're glad to have you here. I want to talk about that $16 trillion figure of interest costs. We'll come back to that a little bit later, actually. But I wanted to ask you, just was like, what was your main takeaway from looking through, digging through this report of showing kind of the trajectory of America's fiscal state here over the next decade?
My biggest shocking takeaway was that by 2036, so 10 years from now, which is at the end of the Congressional Budget Office projection window, we will spend almost all of projected tax revenues, 96% of our projected tax revenues, on so-called mandatory entitlement programs, that's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the debt. So those big categories that are currently the fastest growing budget categories, interest on the debt, as you mentioned, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the big entitlement programs, will consume almost the entirety of revenues by the end of the budget window. So what does that leave for national defense? Other core governmental functions will have to borrow pretty much every penny to fund those other priorities.
Yeah, and of course, we're already borrowing a lot of pennies, borrowing more than $1 trillion a year, actually close to $2 trillion, it looks like. Take us through that part of the report, too, because spending is going to increase. I noticed that tax revenues are also going to increase, but not as quickly. And then, of course, you're filling that difference with, presumably, with borrowing.
In the big picture, we are projected to spend almost $95 trillion over the next 10 years. The current annual budget is about $7 trillion. $95 trillion over the next 10 years, and we're expected to collect $70 trillion in revenue, so that leaves an almost $25 trillion deficit over that period of time. By the way, the current national debt is $31 trillion if you exclude the Social Security and Medicare trust funds and similar intergovernmental debts. Just looking at what the government has borrowed, the fact that we're projected to add $25 trillion to that over the next 10 years is just boggles my mind. And it raises questions about whether bondholders are willingly going to keep financing such high and rising government debt and deficits, and when they're going to demand higher interest rates.
Yeah, and of course, the raw numbers are staggering. You know, you say trillion, we're going to borrow trillions of dollars every year. We're going to borrow tens of trillions of dollars over the next decade. But also the size of the debt relative to the size of America's economy is something that matters. We basically now have a debt the size of our World War II debt, except in peacetime.
This is correct. That is at about 100% of GDP right now. We will surpass our World War II record on the current trajectory by 2030, and then debt will rise steeply from there. CBO projects debt will be at 120% of GDP by the end of the decade. The important takeaway there is that economists have identified debt levels of about 80% of GDP as the threshold above which debt drags down or reduces economic growth. The U.S. might have a little more wiggle room there since we have the U.S. dollar, our extraordinary privilege as a reserve currency. But even so, I would argue that debt that's as large as the U.S. economy and growing is depressing economic growth.
We're talking with Romina Baccia. She is from the Cato Institute, talking about the new CBO report that came out this week, looking at America's fiscal situation over the next 10 years, where we're headed, what we're on track to do. Romina, just about a minute left here. I want to come back to that number that I mentioned at the top, $16 trillion. That's how much we're going to spend just on interest on the debt over the next 10 years. That's money that American taxpayers are paying to the government and not getting anything in return for. I mean, it's just paying off a credit card bill that we've already run up.
It also raises the risk that the Federal Reserve, our central bank, might step in and buy some more of this government debt, so-called quantitative easing, in order to help the government continue to finance these deficits and these shortfalls. And that could result in higher inflation, eroding any affordability gains that this administration is aiming to make.
Yeah, it's just a mess of bad news here. Obviously, higher debts, bigger deficits, all of that, but that means lower economic growth, could mean higher interest rates, could mean higher inflation. A lot of bad news in this report, and we've got 10 years of it to look forward to, or not look forward to, but definitely something that needs to be dealt with a lot sooner than that. Romina, thanks for taking some time with us today and walking us through all that.
Thanks for having me.
And once again, that is Romina Baccia. She is the Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute. You can find her work there at cato.org. Also, check her out on Substack. The Debt Dispatch is her Substack account. Really tremendous analysis there of all of these issues, fiscal policy, economic policy issues that she dissects on there. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bame. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Ronald Reagan scored a landslide reelection victory in 1984, sweeping 49 states. Is it possible for that achievement to be duplicated again? Former Congressman Keith Rothfuss talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Given the seesawing of our national elections over the last 40 years, it might be hard to believe that a presidential candidate could ever win 49 of 50 states. But that is what happened in 1984, when Ronald Reagan's triumphant reelection carried both liberal states, even Maryland and Massachusetts, and conservative ones. Those of us who were adults at the time, only 25% of Americans alive today, witnessed a governing philosophy that empowered people over bureaucrats, communicated in a manner both realistic and optimistic. I reflected on those times during a trip to California last week that included visits to the Reagan Library and to Rancho del Cielo, the ranch near Santa Barbara that President and Mrs. Reagan used as their Western White House. These places feel frozen in time, particularly the modest ranch house with its 70s and 80s era TVs and kitchen appliances. They are a remarkable oasis, testifying to the transcendent themes that swept Reagan into the White House, standing in marked contrast to the broken, yet still beautiful, state of California in which they are located. Given the bitter divisions on our screens daily, it is hard to imagine an electoral map like 1984's. But precedent shows you can go from bitter division to broad consensus in just a few years. Nixon's 1972 49-state landslide came just 4 years after the tumultuous 1968, with its political assassinations, race riots, and violent anti-war protests. For such a landslide to happen, several factors must converge: the right messages on the economy and foreign policy, a communications-savvy candidate who can reconcile those messages with America's ideals, and an opponent with the wrong messages or an inability to communicate a positive vision for the country. Simply put, the quality of candidates matters. The conditions in both 2020 and 2024 had the potential to produce 40-state-plus landslides. The turmoil of the COVID pandemic, armed conflicts in Asia and the Middle East, and the rise of China all gave the right candidate an opening to offer coherent policy prescriptions that, if communicated properly, could flip enough moderately red and blue states to achieve a convincing route that could shift the electorate for a decade or more. But neither party's nominees had what it took to make that happen. Biden and Harris were not competing in places like Indiana, where Obama had won in 2008, and Trump was not competing in places like Virginia. Following the 2024 election, Pew Research took a poll asking voters whether they cast their ballot for their candidate or against the other. Of Trump's 49% share, 40% were voting for him and 9% against Harris. Of Harris's 47%, only 23% were actually for her. 24% were voting against Trump. In other words, roughly a fifth of Trump's voters were motivated by opposition to Harris, while fully half of Harris's voters were motivated by opposition to Trump. That only half of Harris's voters were voting for her is unsurprising. She was a horrible candidate. She was the border czar that hardly ever visited the border as millions crossed. She wouldn't have done anything different from spend and inflate Biden. And her only gift seemed to be constructing word salads that meant nothing. But that half of her voters chose her solely to stop Trump reveals how deeply they disliked him. Enough to hand the most powerful office in the world to someone who is obviously lacking. Some of this may stem from Trump derangement syndrome, but there was likely significant play in the margins among voters who simply were put off by Trump's irreverence, insensitivity, fluid transactionalism, and art of the deal hyperbole. So is there anything to learn from Reagan's landslides compared to today's elections, where large numbers of voters cast ballots not for a candidate, but to thwart one they dislike? Perhaps one lesson is that being visceral doesn't work if you want a landslide. Reagan never shrank from tough rhetoric or bold colors in his speeches, but he did not use language that turned off the middle voters needed for convincing wins and long-lasting political change. That is an especially important point to consider as we approach critical midterm elections. As you leave the Reagan Library and pass the 40th president's final resting place, you encounter one last example of the rhetoric that propelled Reagan's victories. On his grave is the inscription, "I know in my heart that man is good, that what is right will always eventually triumph, and there is purpose and worth to each and every life." Imagine a politician today using such language. We might be surprised by the reaction. This is Keith Rothfuss for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WTRV-FM in Walker, Michigan, WTWZ-FM in Jackson, Mississippi, along with WROK-AM in Rockford, Illinois. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program, please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.